You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Many religions and spiritual groups have rules or traditions when it comes to food, whether it's certain foods or periods of time one shouldn't eat or specific recipes we could associate with a place of worship. Our beliefs can often influence our meals. You might not know some of the religious or spiritual history behind some common foods you find at the grocery store today. In a new book, our next guest digs into the historical connections between American faith and food. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do your beliefs influence what you eat or don't eat? Are there certain foods you associate with your religion or maybe what you eat after a worship session? Did you have a church cookbook or other food tradition involving your place of worship? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Christina Ward is a Milwaukee-based writer and editor who's vice president of the publishing company Feral House. Her latest book is called Holy Food, How Cults, Communes, and Religious Movements Influenced What We Eat and American History. Christina, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to talk about this.
Now, you write in the book that you get asked this a lot, but I'm still going to ask you, what led you down this path? I think it's not a connection a lot of people would immediately leap at, to the connection between faith and food.
Right. I think I put it down to growing up in Milwaukee and then being exposed to a lot of people. Public schools are great. You get to meet folks from different kinds of backgrounds and learn a little bit about what they believe. But it was spending the summers on my grandmother's very rural farm in Jackson County. And it was like the late 70s. And I remember there was an itinerant preacher that came along and was going to take all the kids to a tent revival. And it was kids only. And it makes more sense as an adult that every farm in the area sent their kids. And you got a reward, a little bit of an ice cream sundae if you answered the questions correctly about the Bible. And that, I think, for me, really cemented this idea that food and religion are intertwined and that the food can also serve a purpose for believers.
Part of the story in your book is about food, but a big part of it is also about various new religious movements throughout American history. Now, some of us might think, oh, you know, the 60s, we saw all these new traditions and spiritual awakenings and things like that. I learned from your book, I kind of knew it, but you really spelled it out. This has been a constant in the United States. We're like a laboratory for the creation of new religious and spiritual traditions. Can you talk about that a little before we dig more into the food?
Yeah, absolutely. The United States has essentially a trifecta. There's three big elements that help essentially foster an environment where people feel comfortable about exploring different avenues of worship, of religion. And that is the First Amendment. We don't have a state religion. We don't, you know, have a national religion, whereas many countries, especially in Europe, have a national state religion. And that keeps the belief systems fairly intact. The United States does not have that. And our tax laws are very generous to religious organizations, because primarily when those tax laws were put into place, churches were mainly responsible for the social services that were required to keep a community going. And then, of course, the third thing is our own history of being settled by being occupied by kind of religious fundamentalists.
Some of the common themes that come up again and again, a lot of traditions when it comes to their food end up avoiding meat completely or partially. And that's, some come out of European Christian traditions. Some are coming out of or inspired by, say, Hinduism or Buddhism. Why does vegetarianism keep coming up in so many different new religious movements in the United States?
Especially the ones that are rooted in the Christian tradition, they skim and they thoroughly read the Bible. And, you know, and that's, again, the Old Testament of the Bible is something that the Islam, Judaism, and Christianity all follow. And so the idea of the kashrut, the Leviticus, those rules, those laws are culturally embedded in all of the main religious traditions. But the new religious groups started digging further, and they found a passage in Genesis, and that's very early on, that essentially said that God created plants, seeds, and fruits to be the human food, and therefore human diets should be entirely plant-based.
And so that's the Christian tradition. And but it seems like other sources of vegetarianism found fertile ground in new religious movements in America, too.
Absolutely. And in a lot of the times in the Hindu tradition, there's a concept called ahimsa, and my apologies for my bad pronunciation. And it's a concept that means do no harm, kill no living thing, plants included. And on that spectrum, you'll get varying degrees of vegetarianism and veganism. And it's why many people following Hinduism don't eat meat at all, because killing a creature, killing a living being to make food for yourself would be against the belief system. And at the extreme, many groups like Jainism, they believe even further that you can only eat plants that are regenerative. So if, for example, an apple is okay, because the tree produces it and it falls to the ground. Spinach, because you can clip it and it keeps the plant alive. So anything that doesn't kill the actual plant, whereas like a carrot, you eat a carrot, you pull it out of the ground, that carrot is, you know, essentially dead. So there's always a spectrum in how people interpret the rules and how they apply them.
Talking to Christina Ward, Milwaukee-based writer, about her new book, Holy Food, How Cults, Communes, and Religious Movements Influenced What We Eat and American History. You can join in at 800-642-1234, maybe to share your own story of a connection between food and faith. That's 800-642-1234. Now, Christina, there's a lot of history in the book. There's also a lot of recipes in the book. You're literally looking at all these different faith traditions, big and small. What kind of recipes were you looking for to represent all these diverse religious movements?
I wanted recipes that, one, would taste good if you made them. Of course, you know, there's subjective.
There were some
taste
rejects
issues
out there, I imagine.
There were a lot of rejects. It takes a while for essentially like new vegetarians as a concept to kind of come up to speed when all you know is a very heavy meat-based diet. So these cookbooks and these recipes that the groups published really helped new believers get on the right path for the dietary system. And they also acted as an attractant to new believers. If you picked up an SDA, you know, a Seventh-day Adventist cookbook, you might be more interested in learning about the belief system. And I felt it was important for people to not just read about the food and the groups, but also maybe to try and get a taste of how they ate.
Speaking of Seventh-day Adventists, I'm from Michigan. And there was a little over 100 years ago, a Seventh-day Adventist spa that started with a lot of health treatments, including a lot of enemas and things like that. And it was led by a fellow by the last name of Kellogg. And I eat the descendants of his products all the time. Can you talk about the religious origin of our breakfast cereals shelves at the grocery store?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's, again, it's that convergence of tax laws and, you know, the idea of food and helping the believers and helping people find the right dietary path. And so at the Kellogg Sanitarium, what Kellogg was doing was using Seventh-day Adventist principles about no stimulants of any kind. And the Seventh-day Adventists didn't eat spicy food at all. They felt like even like black pepper was too spicy and would provoke temper. And so it was a time period of a couple things, of really heavy diets in starch. And I'm going to say it, it made people constipated. And so the sanitarium spent a lot of time, Dr. Kellogg, of trying to help people poop. And so a lot of the diet is about really being a little bit more healthy and getting clean on the inside and clean on the outside, because the body is a temple.
And Little Debbie snack cakes too.
Yeah. The Little Debbie snack cake started, they originally used carob and not chocolate. And when the Seventh-day Adventists sold the company, I think in the early 80s, they use chocolate. But if you grew up earlier than that, you might remember the odd taste of those, because they used carob instead of chocolate, kind of a mix. But the first one was the oatmeal cake. And again, it followed all of the principles that the Seventh-day Adventists recommended for their diet. And if it made it easy. And because the tax laws said that you could, as a church, as a religious organization, create and sell products that followed your mission. And that's why we saw in the United States a lot of these groups become entrepreneurial, both in publishing cookbooks and creating products that you see on the grocery shelves today.
We're talking to Milwaukee-based author Christina Ward about her new book. It's called Holy Food, How Cults, Communes, and Religious Movements Influenced What We Eat and American History. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a food you associate with your faith or belief system? Something you eat maybe in the church basement after the service or after a wedding? Or is there a food you associate with funerals or memorials? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, experiences, or questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Christina Ward, writer and editor from Milwaukee, with us today to talk about her new book, Holy Food, How Cults, Communes, and Religious Movements Influenced What We Eat in American History. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see connections between food and religious or spiritual beliefs in your life? What questions do you have about the history of food and religion in the U.S.? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Christina, Johnny Appleseed, I've heard the legends. Johnny Appleseed was real and had a very spiritually based mission in planting those seeds. Can you tell that story?
Yes, absolutely. So John Chapman was a follower of what's called a Swedenborgian religion, and after the Swedish scientist. And again, they were vegetarians and extreme in the sense that they really believed some of that idea of do no harm, kill no plants. And so why that's important to Johnny Appleseed is he had perfected a methodology of starting apple trees from seed, whereas so often people starting orchards were doing that by grafting. And Swedenborg and the believers of that and Chapman felt that that was harming the tree and that was not a good way to start apple farms. And he traveled west throughout the frontier, the country, essentially teaching how to plant apples from seed. Why that's so important is this is the days before water filtration, and finding drinkable water was really critical. And people of that time period didn't always drink straight water. What they were drinking was cider, was drinking what they call small beer, essentially a fermented liquid. And the apples were super critical to creating a cider and creating a liquid that was going to keep people alive.
Now, another theme that pops up in different decades, different faith traditions, Christina, in your book is the idea of opening a restaurant. In some cases, offering free food to bring people into a service. In some cases, as a money-making opportunity, often relying on cheap or free labor of parishioners. Talk about some of the examples where we saw religion turn into restaurant.
It's funny because a few that were started in the 1920s are still operating today. And that's the United House of Prayer for All People that they still offer as part of their service. And primarily they're in the southeast of the United States. There's a great one in DC and in New York. And they offer a cafeteria style, which is great kind of Southern style soul food. And that, again, is part of the practice. It becomes a service to the community because it's very low price. And it's an opportunity for the organization, for the group to earn a revenue, to earn some money to keep their organization going. And of course, very few actually go outwardly proselytizing to try to recruit new members, but they always have material available so you can learn more. One of the modern ones too, you might see is Vegan Hut, Loving Hut Vegan is part of a new religious movement. And so again, they started these restaurants to help generate revenue, do community service, and recruit new members.
A bigger scale example, the Unification Church, run by the late Sun Myung Moon, people derisively call them Moonies sometimes, a huge player in the raw fish for sushi industry.
Yes, they are the providers of almost, I think it's 80% of the sushi fish in the United States. What's most interesting, I think, about the Unification Church's business is that because it is a bit of a closed group, with kind of high standards for their moral behavior of their members who are then also working in the industry, is they've associated with another group to do the transportation. So the Nation of Islam, in a long tradition of training truck drivers and some longshoremen, often work very closely with the Unification Church to help transport that fish. And so that's a really great example of two new religious movements, a little on the extreme side for both, working together to help support each other and their food businesses.
Talking to Christina Ward about her new book, Holy Food, How Cults, Communes, and Religious Movements Influenced What We Eat and American History. Christina, the word cults is in the title there. There's debate over what exactly constitutes a cult. But all that said, there are cases where these things take a darker turn, where food is used in some ways as a way of control, of regulating the lives of members of faith. What were some of the more worrisome stories you ran into?
Absolutely. So, you know, to be clear, a cult is something, a group that has a high control. They're controlling how you think, how you feel, what information can come into your life, as well as some autonomy, bodily control. And that's where the food comes in, about how to control the body. Many of the really high control groups with terrible outcomes often recommended fasting, extreme fasting, or would withhold food as a punishment. I'm thinking, or as a pressure test. Yogi Bhajan, who founded the Happy Holy Healthy Organization and famously wouldn't let people join the group until they did a 3-day garlic fast. And it wasn't so much of a fast as a test. You had to eat garlic for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, one clove, and if for 3 days. And if you could do that, it sent a signal to Bhajan that you were open, you were receptive to following pretty inane directions. And then he knew that that was someone he wanted in his group because they were more controllable.
You also write about foods associated with death and funerals and memorials. Now, there are, I think, foods that people often will bring to that wake or whatever. There were some more closely associated foods that literally you held the food over the deceased, often in a coffin or similar situation. Can you talk about some of those death foods?
And this is a much earlier tradition. So we don't see it much in the 20th century at all. And it's really born out of some of the European folk traditions that then got incorporated into the Christianity. And it's primarily what you see is in the Christian beliefs. And so you hear things in the Dutch have a dudkoks, which is dead cakes. And they were essentially a cookie that memorialized the person who died that people traditionally would eat afterwards. In Wales, they have proper like death cakes and sin eaters, where essentially you'd make a cake and that would represent all of the sins of the person and then consume it and have a designated person consume it. And they were essentially eating the sins of that person, freeing that person to go to heaven. In Bavaria, there was tradition of, again, of putting a cake on the actual corpse for a bit and then consuming it. And you'll see this, it's almost a form of cannibalism. And that's what anthropologists will tell you. And essentially, you're getting that power. You get the power of the person. You're helping absolve them of sins by participating in these rituals of associating the food and death.
I want to check out one of the historical figures you talk about in the book, George Washington Carver. We know him as a scientist, big in developing different forms of agriculture. But you point out something I didn't know. A lot of his work was driven by his faith. What were some of the connections?
Carver... And I look at him as a genius. In all of my research, I'm convinced that more people need to know about George Washington Carver and not just the peanut part. Mm-hmm. He was a brilliant scientist in botany and plants. And what he did was inspired. He felt he heard the voice of God. And he explored, as many people did in the earliest 20th century, not one particular spiritual pathway or joining a church, but many, and being open. And so he was at times a Baptist. He was at times following kind of his own spirituality based on what he was reading and the influences around him. And he felt that his work was necessary and driven by God, who told him that the plants would speak to him and that he really needed to serve his people, and his people being Black people, and trying to teach them to be as self-sufficient as possible. And one of the ways to self-sufficiency, of course, is controlling your own food supply.
And a lot of what he did ends up in food we still eat today. Can you talk about some of the foods, some of them from Africa, I believe, that he helped turn into a part of our agriculture?
Right. So if we think about what is often referred to as the Black Belt, and that is a super soil-rich area in the South, and it's primarily where a lot of enslaved people were kept enslaved. But because that plantation system, it's a monoculture, and it depleted the soils. So in that post-Civil War era, those were soils that weren't great for growing food for the people that were now living there. And so Carver, using plant sources that had long been cultivated by the enslaved people that had come to the United States that they had smuggled from Africa, were great at what's called nitrogen fixing. So he was using cowpeas and using these legumes to not just grow food, but to replenish the soil so it could grow food. And that those breakthroughs, we still use those today.
And briefly, Christina, you gathered recipes from over 200 years of faith traditions. Is there one that you've latched onto that's part of your personal food tradition now?
Well, I've got a sweet tooth, so I have to say that right away. So I'm always going to go for the things that are sweeter.
Same.
There's a group from the 1970s, and they were a UFO / Buddhist / Hindu / pretty much everything kind of cult. And it's called the Sunburst Bakery, and they have a recipe for apple corn cookie. And it's naturally gluten-free. They didn't intend it to be. That's just how they made it. And it's delicious. That's one of my go-to favorites. I've been making it without even telling people because it's just such a good cookie.
Christina, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. And I hope people think about their own food and religion.
That's Christina Ward. Her new book is Holy Food, How Cults, Communes, and Religious Movements Influence What We Eat and American History. Christina will be presenting her book at a pair of talks in Milwaukee this weekend, Good Hope Public Library, Saturday at 2, Lion's Tooth Books, Sunday at 2 p.m. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. Coming up after the news is the American system of government at a breaking point. The authors of a new book say we need to make changes to avoid the risk of authoritarian rule. Check out the argument in Tyranny of the Minority, How American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The U.S. Constitution was once a roadmap for young nations working to establish their own democracies. But our country has undergone massive demographic, economic, and political changes since its birth. In a new book, our guest says our constitutional order is at a breaking point where resistance to multiracial democracy and institutions that allow for control by a reactionary minority could take us from representative government to authoritarianism. But he says it's not too late to change things. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you think the founding fathers got it right or wrong when they wrote the Constitution? Are you worried about the risk of authoritarian rule in the U.S.? Is it time to change things like the Electoral College, the U.S. Senate, court appointments? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Steve Levitsky is the David Rockefeller Professor of Latin American Studies and Government at Harvard University. He co-authored the New York Times bestseller, How Democracies Die. His newest book, he's also the co-author, is called Tyranny of the Minority, Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Before we go under the hood and take a look at the Constitution, can you talk about recent evidence in the United States, I think especially in the aftermath of the 2020 election, of your concerns of Democratic backsliding in this old democracy?
Sure. We in the United States are not accustomed to experiencing Democratic backsliding. We've had a pretty stable constitutional order for a very long time, certainly any of our lifetimes. You have to go back to the Civil War to see any sort of rupture of the constitutional order. But just about every international monitor or index of democracies, organizations that monitor the level of democracy across the world, all of them registered a pretty significant decline in the level of democracy in the United States beginning in 2016. Just to take one example, Freedom House, which is a U.S.-based organization that monitors democracy across the world, 10 years ago gave the has a global freedom index that ranges from zero, dictatorships like North Korea, to 100, which is a handful of democracies. And a decade ago, the United States got a pretty good score, 94, which put it on par with Germany and UK, Canada, Japan. But now it is down to, it has fallen from 94 to 83, which is still a democracy, but less democratic, according to Freedom House, than Mongolia and Argentina. And that's pretty shocking to many Americans. But when you have violent threats against election workers, violent threats against elected officials, prosecutors, when you have an effort by an incumbent president to overturn the results of an election, you fall to the point where Freedom House considers you less democratic than Argentina. So democracy has not died in the United States, but it has backslid in the last 6 or 7 years.
You point out in the book a key feature of a successful representative government is that parties are willing to lose, that they can recognize, okay, we lost, we need to change our message, come back in 4 years or 3 years or whatever that country's particular time range is. And there's a fear in the book that that's no longer the case, that we no longer accept that we might lose and we might look for alternate non-election related means to not lose.
Sure. So this is the cardinal rule of democracy, is that parties, all political parties that participate in a democracy, must be willing to accept defeat, accept the results of elections, win or lose. We actually, in the book, lay out three very simple criteria to determine whether a political party is committed to democracy. Basically, what the political scientist Juan Linz called loyal Democrats, parties that are committed to democracy, have to do three basic things. One of them, I just mentioned, they have to accept the results of elections. Another one, very basic, is they must always unambiguously renounce political violence. And third, maybe most importantly of all, they need to break publicly and thoroughly, wash their hands of all extremist anti-democratic forces, particularly those in their own camp, on their own flank. Unfortunately, looking at the Republican Party since 2016, but especially since 2020, the bulk of the party leadership is failing on all three of those criteria.
And those are symptoms, if I'm reading your book right, of two big changes or two big concerns. First of all, Steve, you and your co-authors say we are on the verge of something unprecedented in some ways, the rise of a functioning multiracial democracy, but at the same time, you see a backlash, a reaction to that.
Yeah, the story in our book is not entirely bleak. It's not all bad news. There's some really good news. The United States has been, over the last half century, but really, especially in the last couple of decades, has been approaching something really quite unique and quite distinctive, which is a truly multiracial democracy. And in fact, we are about to become the first democracy in history, if we manage to make it through, in which a dominant ethnic group loses its numerical majority and its dominant status in society. That's a really big shift. It's a really big change. It is, I think, been much more consequential than most of us anticipated. That's why, at least in the argument in the book, that's why we're sort of in this storm that we're in right now. Because it's not easy for a dominant ethnic group to lose its dominance, 200 years of dominance. But if we get there, and I think we will become one of the world's few multiracial democracies and ideally can be a model for the rest of the world. The problem is that there has, in fact, we shouldn't have been surprised perhaps, but been a pretty intense reaction. Groups that have been sitting at the top of economic, social, cultural, political hierarchies for decades don't necessarily like those hierarchies being challenged.
Talking to Steve Levitsky, co-author of the new book, Tyranny of the Minority, Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Steve, before we go to our callers, one of the fundamental concerns you have in your book is that, you know, our Constitution was state-of-the-art in a lot of ways when it came into being, but you see a lot of countries making more progress in advancing their constitutions, making them more democratic, and we're stuck, you say, with a lot of institutions that allow a small group to hold on to power. What are some of your main concerns?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the good news is that authoritarian forces in the United States, which I would characterize as, say, the MAGA forces, are not and have never been a majority of Americans, and they haven't been a majority of the electorate or voters. The problem is that our institutions, our pretty unique institutions, allow them to thwart electoral majorities and sometimes even govern over electoral majorities. The United States is the only presidential democracy in the world where the loser of a presidential election can win the presidency. We are the only democracy in the world where a partisan minority in the Senate can systematically and permanently block legislation, regular legislation, that's supported by a majority. We have one of the most malapportioned Senates on earth, a Senate in which you get equal representation no matter what the population of your state. So we represent land, not people. That is fundamentally not democratic. And we're the only democracy in the world where Supreme Court justices have lifetime tenure security, where there isn't either term limits or retirement age. So all of this allows, in a way that exists in no other democracy, allows partisan minorities in some circumstances to either at the very least thwart, but in many cases actually rule over majorities. And as you said, we had a very, very progressive constitution at the outset. We were far and away the most democratic country on earth when the constitution was written. But other democracies over the course of more than 100 years, especially the 20th century, gradually democratized their senates, established term limits on the Supreme Court. In Latin America, other presidential democracies eliminated their electoral college. So they gradually took steps to make their systems more democratic. We did too, of course. We expanded the suffrage. We, in the early 20th century, we began to directly elect the Senate. We have also taken steps to democratize our system over the course of a couple hundred years. But in the last half century, we've kind of stopped doing that work. We've stopped doing the work of working to make our system democratic, more democratic. And as a result, we've fallen behind other established democracies.
Let's bring on a caller now. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hello.
Steve, I couldn't agree more. Perhaps if we appointed you dictator, you could resolve all of these issues for us. But we have so many problems. We have a gerontocracy in the United States Senate. We have the Electoral College, which is outdated and obsolete. We have the power of incumbency making these jobs a virtual sinecure for, you know, Congress and Senate, and these people stay in there for years, and you can't tell me there's not one single person in their district to challenge them and bring in some new ideas. I lived in Ireland, and we had a system of proportional representation, multi-seat constituencies, and single transferable vote.
Tom, thanks for the call. You've already given us a lot to talk about there. Steve, you had mentioned your concerns about the Electoral College in the book, something along the lines of proportional representation. You would agree with Tom on.
Yeah, well, first of all, let me make clear, not only do I not think anybody should be dictator, but I would be an especially bad dictator. Let me make that clear. You don't want me as dictator. But that said, we in the final chapter of our book have a list of 15 proposed institutional reforms. One of them is to abolish the Electoral College. Another one is to replace our first-past-the-post electoral system with a system of proportional representation more similar to what exists in most European democracies. And that would eliminate the possibility of gerrymandering and make it much less likely that politicians can sort of, first of all, carve out their own district with an electorate that suits them, and then maintain themselves in power because it's very difficult to challenge them. A proportional representation system, again, it avoids gerrymandering. It avoids the kind of manufactured majorities and supermajorities that you get in the Wisconsin legislature, and would avoid the re-election over and over and over again of individual legislatures.
Thanks for that call, Tom. We're talking to Steve Levitsky, co-author of the new book, Tyranny of the Minority, Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the ideas, the suggested changes you've heard so far? Are there other changes you'd like to see to make American government work better? However you define that, be more democratic, however you define that. Join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Steve Levitsky, co-author of the new book, Tyranny of the Minority, Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior now. Jeff, hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. I couldn't disagree more with one of the things your guest said here today. I switched from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party because of the Second Amendment. We have the right as a people to bear arms and replace our government if it does not responsive to or represent our needs. That's the purpose of the Second Amendment, is to maintain that right to bear arms and overthrow our government. In fact, Gandhi said the only time nonviolence really is effective is when you have the option to choose violence.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Steve, I don't know if that's the right reading of the original Second Amendment.
Yeah, I'm going to say that nowhere in the Constitution does it say that we have a right to overthrow the government via arms. I'm just going to go out and say that.
There's a lot of argument about the history of the Second Amendment and why it was one of the guaranteed liberties. At best, Jeff's point, I think, is controversial.
Yeah, I think it's wrong.
Okay. Thanks for calling in, Jeff. We'll go now to Nancy in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I think it's really imperative that at the present time we try to change the Constitution so that the term of presidency is one term only. That would nicely eliminate the incumbency, and I think that one term should be 6 years in length, because at the present time and ever before in the past, every president spends the last 2 years of the first term running for the second term. And all that time, energy, and money and enthusiasm would therefore be spent on the work that America needs done and the world needs done, because he can't run for a second term. There is no second term.
Nancy, thanks for the call. And that's basically the Mexican presidential system, Steve, 1 6-year term. I've seen concerns that people argue that gives too much power to the party that picks each successive president. What do you think of Nancy's suggestion?
Well, you stole my line there. I'm supposed to be a specialist in Latin America.
Sorry.
So I was gonna say that that's precisely the system that they have in Mexico. It's an interesting and a plausible idea. I prefer a U.S. style two-year term system. I would not advocate for changing that. Because I think that it's true that the president spends the last year thinking a lot about re-election, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's re-election that gets the pursuit of re-election that keeps our politicians honest, that keeps our politicians responsive, hopefully, to voters. And arguably, or what I fear, is that a president not facing re-election would be even less responsive to voters than they are now. 6 years, I've seen arguments made for it. Other democracies have experimented with it. Mexico's done it for decades and decades. It's certainly doable. My fear there is that sometimes presidents fail and really need to be just don't do well and lose public support, lose public consensus, and they become lame ducks. And if you become a failed president in your second or third year, it's a long way to get to 6 years. And we've seen in some countries that those last couple of years can be pretty traumatic if you have if there's no mechanism to remove a failed president.
Thanks for the call, Nancy. Talking to Steve Levitsky, co-author of the new book, Tyranny of the Minority, Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. John is with us now in Oshkosh. John, hello.
Hello. I have a question. I guess I just want to make sure we're talking on the right terms. I've always understood that we are not a democracy, a true democracy. We're a constitutional republic. Is that correct?
Partially. We are certainly a republic, which means that we are not a monarchy. When the founders talked about a republic, what they meant, every major country in the world at the time of the U.S. founding was a monarchy. It was the only system really existing in the West. And so creating a system that was in which the government was selected by the people and not through hereditary succession was a dramatic change. And that's a system that was called a republic. It was a system of rule by the people. Now, democracy in the founders' minds back in the 18th century meant pure majority rule. It meant direct democracy, rule by the masses. That's never what we were. It's not what we became. What we think of as democracy today is something very different. When I say the word democracy, I mean representative democracy. I mean a system where the people elect representatives that rule us. I also mean liberal democracy, a democracy in which majority rule is tempered by minority rights, basic civil rights, so that at whatever government we elect cannot take from me my right to free speech, my right to associate, my right to assembly, my right to publish, my right to religious practice. So a modern democracy, what we call democracy in Sweden, in Uruguay, in Costa Rica, in Germany, in the UK, Canada, New Zealand, the United States, is a liberal representative democracy, a system of majority rule, but in which we indirectly rule, the people rule indirectly by electing representatives, and the people have their basic civil liberties protected. That is what journalists, politicians, political scientists all call modern democracy, and it's been that way for a century or so.
Thanks for the call, John. Greg in Toma couldn't stay on the line, but brings up a point. He says the Constitution is based in part on ethics and people's obligation to do the right thing. We run into problems, Greg says, when people stray away from that. And you talk in the book, Steve, about our reliance on norms and what happens when people find things that are norms but not necessarily laws and start to exploit them. What are solutions to that?
Right. So that is absolutely right. There is no Constitution, no set of rules, no set of laws that simply by writing them down on paper can automatically make a society function well. A democracy must have good rules, must have a good constitution. We do have a good constitution. But any society, in order for democracy to work well, must have a set of informal rules, unwritten rules, norms that guide the way that we behave. And in How Democracies Die, we spent a lot of time discussing how in the 20th century, U.S. democracy was sustained by a set of informal norms in which politicians recognized that even though legally there were certain lines they could cross, that they shouldn't do it. And those norms have been breaking down. And I think even since we published How Democracies Die 5 years ago, 6 years ago, those norms have corroded even further, and which is why our politics, if you compare it to when I was growing up in, say, the 1980s, the 1990s, our politics are now much more of a sort of no holds barred contest in which anything can happen. You can try to impeach the president for anything. You can refuse to let the president fill a Supreme Court vacancy. You can investigate the president for anything. You can shut down the government. It's by any means necessary politics. And that one is a function of the erosion of our norms of self-restraint. And two, leads to unstable, ineffective democracy that is going to threaten our power, our prestige, our place in the world.
Steve, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Steve Levitsky, co-author of the new book, Tyranny of the Minority, Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time.